Good morning. Can you turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 7? We'll read there in a few moments. Some of you may know, but many of you may not. Ken and Wendy are not here this morning because Jenna finally went into labor. And she was over a week late, which they say like dog years are like seven times. You know, days late giving birth or is much more than seven times. So she probably felt at least 49 days late. You're disappointed? I bet you're shocked that Teresa knows more about childbirth than I do. My job is in danger. Did you know that most first-time moms, I was reading this week. No, but they actually, if the baby goes ahead and presents itself today, she will miss Jamie Dixon's birthday by one day. Now, Jamie told me about 10 times today that yesterday was his birthday. And he's 19 years old, and he wanted me to tell Josh. And I said, we don't announce birthdays for everybody, you know, unless you're in your 90s. Then we announce it. That didn't seem to matter at all to Jamie. So I just have to say, Jamie, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but we cannot announce your birthday. So it's just the way it goes. Sometimes the rules hurt and to put them into practice, but we got to stick with our policy there. In about 1950, my dad moved our family, and I wasn't around yet for about 10 more years, but he moved our family into a house he built. And actually, it's more accurate to say he moved the family, he and my mom and the five kids at the time. Four more came later, but mom, dad, and five kids moved into a house that only had the four outside walls and a roof. My dad built the house largely on his own. My oldest brother, Don, was 10 years old at the time, and he helped out in every way that a 10-year-old can. And Dad's older brother, Uncle Bob, came and helped Dad do the roof. But largely, my dad built that house by himself in the evenings after work. They rented a house a couple of lots over on the street where our house was, and he would come home from work and just go continue building the house. But, money was tight, and the lease came up on the rental house, and the other house wasn't ready. But rather than sign a new lease, he went ahead and moved them all in. And so there were no interior walls. And my brother Don, again, who was 10 at the time, wasn't happy with that because he didn't like, and there were also no curtains on the windows. So he didn't want to go to the bathroom or change clothes. Yeah. And but my dad was the kind of man who thought kids should not complain. Especially in 1950. Kids, he mellowed out in his later years like most of us do. But so what he said to my brother was, "Bud," which is what he called all the guys, and all the girls were gal. There's kind of a simple elegance to that rather than learning the names. But what he said was, "Bud, if the neighbors never seen one, they won't know what it is. And if they have seen one, they won't be shocked." This somehow didn't comfort my brother. He God bless my dad. He knew the way to, you know, to calm anxious hearts. But he was building a house because he had a family. And if you have a family, you need a house. You need a place to live. And, you know, that house is where the nine of us grew up. That house became woven into who we were as a family. And I'm sure that can be degrees of how true that is for you based on, you know, if you moved a whole lot, maybe you didn't, get that connected to one place. But for us, it was the house that our whole family grew up in. And it was a really strange and weird and sad kind of thing to sell that house after my mom died in 2003. Because it was woven into our family's identity. It's a part of who we are. You know, last week we talked about God's unbelievable vision for the church. In Ephesians chapter 3, especially in verse 10, it says, "It was God's intent that the wisdom of God in all its rich variety would be displayed through the church." And we talked about how unbelievable that is in some way. Like, we have trouble believing that. Now, we can believe that God is wise. It's one thing to say God is wise. It's quite another thing to say that through the church, God's wisdom in all its variety would be on display. The manifest wisdom of God would be on display all around through the church. We have trouble believing that because we've seen the church and it's us. And we have issues. We have baggage. We have problems. We're broken, like Stephanie was just talking about. But the fact remains that it was God's intent, and God believed it's totally possible, it's totally true that the wisdom of God is on display through us. And one of the main ways that the New Testament talks about the church is the family of God, the household of God. And if you're a family, you need a house. And this might be a good time to talk about our building here and the fact that we're kind of busting at the seams up there and we need to expand, but I'm not going to talk about that today. We'll talk about that later. I'm going to talk about a different kind of house in Matthew 7, 21. It says, "Not everyone," Matthew 7, 21, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles?' Then I will tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.' Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on a rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, and the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash." Jesus says, the person who hears these words of mine and put them into practice is like a wise man who builds his house on a rock. The church is the family of God. And if you're family, you need a house. And really, ultimately, the house that we live in is the house that's built by hearing the words of Jesus and putting them into practice. That's what wise men and wise women do. They hear the words of Jesus and they put them into practice. That's the house that we live in. That's the house that is supposed to become woven into our family's identity. Not bricks and mortar. Although it's good to have a place to meet, right? No more hauling tubs around and, you know, madness like that. But you know, we can do church without a building. But you can't do church. You can't be church without the house of the wise. The house that's built by hearing the words of Jesus and putting them into practice. Has anybody noticed that already folks are gearing up for a 2016 presidential election? People are declaring their candidacy. And, you know, people from among our peers, normal everyday people just like us, are running for president. Just ordinary everyday billionaires like us. Because that's what it takes to get elected, to at least have access to billions of dollars. So that's just beginning. But another thing I'm waiting on is a thing that I saw for the first time in the 2012 election, and that's what they call the truthometer. There's some people, apparently it's their job to listen to politicians as they campaign and do fact checks. This candidate claimed this. This scores a 73 on the truthometer. It's not my purpose to wade too far into politics. The point here is that we live in a very skeptical society. And in a sense, it's my opinion that that it's really a good thing for there to be such thing as a truthometer. But you know what? The world around us has a truthometer pointed at the church. And the truth is about the truthometer, that truthometer doesn't care at all what our doctrine of the Trinity is. I'm not saying the doctrine of the Trinity is not important. But when the world aims its truthometer at us, it really could care less about what we believe about baptism or the Lord's Supper or church governance. They really couldn't care less. I'm not saying baptism and the Lord's Supper and church governance are not important. I'm saying they're not important to the world around us. When the world points its truthometer at us, it wouldn't use these words, but really what they're looking for is whether or not we hear the words of Jesus and put them into practice. Are we people that talk a good game? Or does this really make a difference in the way we live? That's what the world around us is looking at it. Another way to say it is, does the way that you live and the way the things you believe, the way they're reflected in your life, does it really work? Because sometimes there's some of us that are kind of traditionalists, and we can hold on to things just because it's the way it's always been, even if it doesn't work. But the world around us is not willing to hold on to things that we may be so devoted to because it's the way it's always been, but they actually don't work for us. The people around us aren't gonna embrace that. They're looking to see if we have a real faith that translates into a real lifestyle of hearing the words of Jesus and putting them into practice. Even if they don't use those words, that's what they're looking for. They're looking at our lives to see how we deal with things like adversity. They're going to look at our lives and see how we face suffering and loss and disappointment. They're going to look at us and see if we're really willing to forgive. They're looking at us to see if we really can be gracious and embracing of people who are different than we are. Because anybody in this community, anybody in our neighborhoods can huddle up with people just like them and that think exactly the way they do. And pretend that that's a reflection of Christian community. When really it's more like kind of an attaboy club. I like you because you think just like me. I like you because you look just like me. I like you because your skin is exactly the same color as mine, even the freckles. They're wondering if our faith provides us with tools to have a working marriage. They're wondering if our vision of Jesus provides us a good understanding of what it takes to be a parent. And we could just go on and on, but basically, does your faith really work? It's kind of like, you know, at the end of my life, what I leave to my kids, I know they're hoping I'm going to leave something to them that has value and something they actually need and want. You know, it's not going to be super inspiring. You know, at the end of my life, if I say, listen, kids, I've got great news for you. Here's what I've got to leave you. My hearing aid, my walker, you know, my blood pressure medicine, hemorrhoid cream. I've got, and I leave these to you, and they're going to go, yes. And actually, they might at that point. You know, is your faith, is your walk with God something you really are in awe of and desire and embrace and love, or it's something you need? Because what? Well, because the consequences if you didn't have it. Kind of the fire insurance. I don't want to go to hell, so I'll go to church. I don't want to go to hell, so I'll show up and I'll take communion. And I've been baptized, and I'll read my Bible, and I'll pray because I don't want to go to hell. As opposed to, I believe that the ways of Jesus are life itself. That there's nothing that compares to the power and the brilliance and the grace of the ways of the kingdom of heaven. I'm not forced to do it. I fully surrender to the Lordship of Jesus voluntarily because I've never seen anything better. You know, we all follow somebody. If somebody asks you why you're a disciple of Jesus, I think the best answer is, who else did you have in mind? Because we all follow somebody. Who else do you have in mind? But this is not a burden. This is what I do because I believe. Because I believe. And when I talk about dealing with adversity or suffering, or getting our faith giving us help in our marriage or our parenting or these other things, it's not that we have it all together. My goodness, it's not that we have it all together. You know, the church has at times been a sort of a strange, dysfunctional hospital where we only accept the healthy and we shoot the sick and wounded. But Jesus embraces us in our brokenness, and then he shows us a better way. But then because we embrace a Lord and Savior that embraces us in our brokenness, we then embrace each other in our brokenness. In James 2:14-19, it says, "What good is it, my brothers, if a man claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such a faith save him? Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to him, 'Go, I wish you well, keep warm and well fed,' but does nothing about his physical needs, what good is it? In the same way, faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead. But someone will say, 'You have faith, I have deeds. Show me your faith without deeds, and I'll show you my faith by what I do.' You believe that there's one God? Good. Even the demons believe that and shudder." You know, James is one of those challenging little books in the Bible, challenging little letter that's all about putting faith into practice. It challenges us to not just be hearers of the word, but doers, and to look into the word of life as looking into a mirror. But then not forgetting what you've seen, but going and putting it into practice. And it talks about things like keeping a tight rein on our tongues, and about taking care of widows and orphans, and not showing favoritism, and all these things that will just flow from us as we hear the words of Jesus and put them into practice. It's a challenge to all of us to look at our lives and to see if there are areas where we're just being hearers of the word and not doers. I said it right. Woo! Anybody got the truthometer pointed at me here? That's a good thing. But it talks about this devotion to each other. Here's the problem. It's actually inconvenient. You know why looking out for each other is inconvenient? Because we're messed up. We're messy. Life is messy. And it's inconvenient to wade into other people's mess. Did you know? It's like it's a blessing from God on the day that we figure out that it's inconvenient for other people to wade into our mess. That's a good day in your marriage when you figure out, you know what? It's really inconvenient for my spouse to wade into my mess. Faith without deeds is dead. It's always been true. But I think there's never been a time in history that it's been more important for the church to embrace this truth. Because the church is not the center of society anymore, if it ever really was. The church is not the center and focal point of society. But it's at a time when this world needs the church more than it ever has. And I believe the world is feeling its need for something different more than it ever has. We talked about that in Ephesians 3, Paul says that the church, it's God's intent for the church to put the wisdom of God on display. And the way that we do that is by hearing the teachings of Jesus and putting them into practice. But check this out. He didn't say that the wisdom of God would be on display through church services. Now, I hope that as we come together, that we see the wisdom of God in each other and in the ways that we worship, and I pray that you get some wisdom from God from me or whoever does a lesson. But the way that the church puts God's wisdom on display is not even primarily about church services. It's about the way the church, us, the family of God, the way we put it on display in our lives, in our relationships with each other, in our marriages, with our children. I think it's a really great thing to bring people to church. But you don't have to bring somebody to church to show them the wisdom of God. They see it in you, not just the church you go to. But I think one of the greatest, most powerful witnesses to the wisdom of God is that when people get to see us doing life together. We're all included in the church, but throughout the New Testament, when it talks about the church, we might identify with it personally, and I think it's a great thing to take it personally, to take it to heart. But when the Bible talks about the church and what the church is supposed to do, it's personal, but it's not private. You know what I'm saying? Take it personally. You personally are connected to Jesus and to Jesus' church, but it's not private. It's not you in isolation. The impact and the way that the wisdom of God is displayed is a relational thing. It's something that we do together. God is a relational God. And God's wisdom is shown best in relationship. You know, the local church is an organization. Specifically, we're a 501c3. Exactly what Jesus had in mind, right? But we're more than an organization. We're an organism. We're connected. We're as Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 12 and Romans 12, we're a body that's connected, and we all need each other, and we're all important. It's so important for us to be intimately connected in relationships. You know, summer serve is such a great time. To come together on Wednesday nights and to do projects together and so many different things. And I think it's a great picture of the body working together. I'll tell you something else I experienced recently, and because I have a bad memory, I can't remember if I've used this in an example in a sermon since then, but The Gravity camp out, the middle school ministry camp out that we did a few weeks ago, amazing picture of the body working together. The Neelys came, and Anna Neely had never been camping before. She was a star, by the way. She was an amazing camper. I walked to the, she was like cooking this meal on a camp stove, and I mean, she had it going on. But this was really cool. They got there. She's never set up a tent before. She and the kids rode separately from Chuck, who was coming straight from work, I think. But when they got there, Steve Thomas, Hosea Costa, and Isaac Lee were over there. I mean, in 10 minutes, they had the Neely set up. And it was a whole weekend, several days, the Memorial Day weekend of, it was a whole weekend of, you need anything? Hey, I made some jambalaya. You want some? Are you kidding me? We had all these gourmet campfire chefs around there. I didn't even cook the food I brought. It was a solid weekend of, one, relaxing, which is awesome. But it was a solid weekend of, does anybody need anything? I was like, this is the way church ought to be. I even thought we had an amazing communion service. And we had a few things that we don't normally have in communion services. One, we had 5 dogs. And 20 kids. You know, and I was thinking, and red Solo cups. Who knew? Little bitty ones. Solo communion cups, if you can believe that. Thought maybe that's what we need to make, communion more engaging. I think we should start just with the dogs. It was about being together and doing life together. And let me just say, you know, right now it's great to do summer serve together, but in the fall we're going to start life groups back. And if you haven't been in a life group, let me encourage you to connect with a life group. When a group, a smaller group, gets together and just does life together. We pray and we study the word and we fellowship and we talk about what's going on and we're there for each other. And they're really designed to be groups where it's, anybody need anything? Dogs and Solo cups optional. But does anybody need anything?